forehead tightened. That stare was killing me. That pause was killing me. Until, finally...
I saw you got into Harvard, Holmes.
Nothing could have surprised me more, Jean. I hadn't told anyone about my acceptance email. Not you, not my parents. How do you know?
I was poking through the school server.
He said it so nonchalantly, as if it were perfectly normal, as if I shouldn't care. But I did. Why were you on the school server? And why were you looking at my emails? His hands lifted defensively.
It wasn't on purpose, Holmes. I told you, I came here to find something.
A key, I said, my tone mocking and harsh. So you can walk through walls and whatever other nonsense it is you like to do. That hurt him. I saw it in the way his face fell.
Someone has to step outside the rules, he said eventually. How else can I help the people enslaved by them?
And why do you have to help them at all? Hacking into the school's system will get you expelled.
So? So what if that happens? Why do you care?
Because... I stopped. I had to swallow, had to gather my thoughts and tamp down this heat that strained against my stomach.
Because what?
Nothing. I looked down at my shadowed calculus homework. A slow rhythm was thumping through the walls now, completely at odds with the frustration building in my lungs. It was the same fury I'd felt when Jim had grilled me on becoming a lawyer. Irrational, childish, and bubbling over too fast. I mean, why should I be the one to confess how I felt? Wasn't it obvious? Jim didn't push me, though. Not yet. Instead, he asked,
"Will you go? To Harvard, I mean?"
"Of course."
"Then why haven't you told anyone about the acceptance? It came in 2 weeks ago, surely. What are you waiting for?"
My breath caught. He had said my name. For the first time ever, Jim had said my name, and it was all too much. I angled my body toward him, one shoulder inside the dorm, one shoulder out. "What do you want from me, Jim?" He shook his head.
"Don't make me say it. Not if you can't."
His voice was softer now, his body, his face moving ever so slightly toward me.
"Or can you?"
"You're going to leave, aren't you?" Our faces were mere inches apart now. "Once you find what you've come for, you'll leave. But I won't."
"You could, though,"
he murmured, closer, closer.
"Come with me, Shirley."
"Where?"
"Outside."
"I need more than that, Jim." My forehead scrunched up. "I'm not like you. I like walls and rules and structure."
"I see."
He gave a tiny nod, and the bomb finally went off. Detonating in my ribcage, it kicked out a single, booming heartbeat straight against my ribs. Then it happened. Finally, and so gently. That's the only word I can find to describe what we shared. The way Jim pulled me to him, the way he leaned in, the way his gaze flicked from my lips to my eyes, making sure I wanted this. I did. So badly I thought I would drown from wanting. He closed the space between us. Our mouths touched. Just a brush of skin. His upper lip grazing my lower. That was all it was, but I couldn't breathe, or move, or think. For the 10 seconds, or 10 minutes, or however long our lips hovered together, I tasted the outside, the real, the free fall of Jim and me, together for one perfect moment. His hands, warmer now, tangled in my hair. My hands, a bit colder, cupped his face. Deep, long, starving. Jim kissed me like we were dying. Because time was up, and this was goodbye. This story ends with a kiss. I mean, sure, while I watched Jim disappear across the rooftop, the night folding over him, I prayed that I would see him again. That our time was up, for now, but not forever. Yet I knew. People don't kiss like it's their last, unless it is. The next day, a Saturday, I went to the library. I had no other way of finding Jim, no phone number, no email, and though I didn't think he'd actually be there, I went to check anyway. You probably don't remember, but it was a gorgeous January day, so bright that sunshine cut right through those foggy windows, and the sparrows sent shadows flying across the floorboards. On my chair lay a tattered red book with gold letters stamped onto the cover. Grimm's Fairy Tales, it read, and a chuckle bubbled in my chest at the sight of it. Until my eyes hit the chessboard, atop which two pieces glowed in the sunbeams. A white queen and a black king, tipped sideways. Checkmate. I didn't cry. I thought I would, but as I sat there staring at those pieces, no tears pricked behind my eyes, no sobs gathered in my lungs. Instead, something warm shimmered through me. From my toes, it gusted and raced and grew until all I could do was clutch my arms to my chest and smile. I smiled so big it actually hurt my cheeks. It hurt my ribs and my lungs, too. Eventually, I scooped up the Book of Fairy Tales. There was no message or anything inside. I hadn't thought there would be, since the book and the chessboard were message enough. Then I sauntered languidly away from the table, away from the sunshine and the sparrows and the landscaping, away from that stolen world trapped between. And as I walked, with a very rebellious angle to my strut, if I do say so myself, I thought everything was going to be okay. I thought, like an idiot, that we would be together one day. That I was in love with him, and he, despite everything, was in love with me back. But I was still just Madame Bovary, clinging to fairy tales that could never be, which is what had set us apart from the very beginning, though I didn't see it until too late. It's what will set us apart forever. What we believe in. Or rather, the fact that I, Shirley Holmes, believe in something at all. And he, Jim Moriarty, does not. Now here we are, and nothing's okay. I need to apologize for what happened to your family, for what Jim did to them and so many people when he released those files. Scandal in Bohemia, they're calling it on the news, and then there's a picture of your mom, with the headline, Senator Rita Watson's private emails hacked, evidence of bribes in the Senate. I think I helped him, Jean. I think I helped Jim get access to those files that have left your mom facing expulsion. But I swear I didn't mean to. I swear I didn't know what I was doing. All I can guess is that Jim somehow used your emails to gain access to your mom's server, which in turn gave him access to all her files. I also know that this scandal in Bohemia has everyone freaking out and blaming your mom. But while the media and the masses are so focused on the pawns getting crushed by kings, they're forgetting that not all kings are bad. Jim's certainly forgotten it, if he ever knew it at all. That's why I have to stop him before any more files get leaked, before any more innocents get hurt. I know, we're supposed to start our first semester together at Harvard in a month, but I can't do that anymore. Don't you see? Not while your family is hurting. Not while Jim Moriarty is still out there somewhere, walking free. But I'll find him, Jean. I'm taking a class on computer forensics now, and everything I learn I'll use to make this better. Being a lawyer was never for me. At least Jim was right about that. But helping people and getting justice for the victims, that is me. Starting now and on my own terms. Sometimes the only way to fix a broken wall is to patch it up from within. I'm not a ghost trapped in purgatory, nor a girl waiting for men to decide her fate. White Queen to E6. I'm coming for you, Jim Moriarty. Checkmate. Your BFF, Shirley Holmes. Dear Sasha, The 411 for Villains, by Sasha Alsberg. The thing that unnerves me about James Moriarty is that he doesn't have any unrealistic powers or live in a made-up world. Quite the contrary, actually. He lives in the United Kingdom. He is a professor, mathematician, son, and brother. Without adding the criminal mastermind factor to him, He seems like a pretty ordinary guy. So why does this bother me? Well, it creeps me out because this guy, this crazy, intelligent, psycho man, could very realistically live in this world, our reality, which means he could also be online, stalking villain forums, giving advice on how to dance on the ashes of your enemies. And so could I. Dear Sasha, the 411 for villains. About me. Some of you may think you know me, but maybe that's just what I want you to think. Have you ever thought of that? It only took a few sweet nothings and words of a white lie to structure my ultimate facade. It was good fun for a while, but now I am ready to share my advice with some sorry souls who need a little help in the criminal mastermind world. Being a criminal mastermind isn't a job. It's a lifestyle. Love, Sasha. One fed-up failure. Retweet Sasha. Dear Sasha, I have been struggling with the criminal mastermind lifestyle, not because I don't want to become one, but because whenever I try to do something evil, well, I get caught. I've had to move 10 times in the past year just to avoid the cops. Do I just suck at being a villain? All I want is to weasel my way into people's lives and take all their money. Is that too much to ask? That being said, how can I avoid getting caught? I need your help. Sincerely, One Fed Up Failure. Sasha, retweet One Fed Up Failure. Dear Fed Up Failure, wow, you got yourself in a pickle, haven't you? It sure is a bummer when you can't do what your heart desires. Something you need to remember is we all have to start somewhere and learn from our past actions. You seem to be trying a bit too hard to stay inconspicuous. Try becoming close friends with some trust fund babies and earning their respect. Get close to them. It may take a while, a few months to a few years, but once you have them in your grasp, clamp shut and take everything you can grab and get the heck out of there. Don't run and hide. Get ahead of the game and work your way up to the top. You got this. Best, Sasha. Undermind Underlord. Retweet Sasha. Dear Sasha, I have been trying to blackmail my arch-nemesis Frederick for 2 weeks now. I need him to respect me and the power I have over him, but I'm having a serious problem. He thinks I'm a joke. Whenever I threaten to expose his secret life as a cosplayer, he seems to not care. I'll insert a section of our text messages. Me. Frederick Monsteppi, you need to deliver $100,000 to the corner of Share Drive and Lock Street by Wednesday, July 5th, or else I will expose your secret life of cosplay to the world. Frederick. Hello again, Nigel. Might as well get some promotion from this, so make sure when you expose me to tag my cosplay page at FredCauseALot. Thanks, buddy. Do you see the disrespect he has for me? I am sick of this. Please, Sasha, tell me what to do. I need your supreme guidance. Sincerely, Undermind Underlord. Sasha, retweet Undermind Underlord. Dear Underlord, the problem is simple. Your leverage against him is so utterly weak that it's not even a threat. Cosplay? Really? Cosplay is so cool. Nerd culture is nothing to be ashamed of, and neither is cosplaying. So what you need to do is find something juicy to use against him, like a dirty hobby, a secret dungeon, a hidden child, or a missing ex-lover. It needs to be something police-worthy, and if he has nothing, make something up. Also, Frederick knew who you were, so that broke one of the major rules of thievery. Never expose yourself until the time is right. Good luck on your quest, Underlord. Best, Sasha. Professor James Moriarty, retweet Sasha. Dear Sasha Marie Alsberg, I know a lot about you. I have been studying you for a while through this forum of yours, and let me say, I'm impressed. But I now have some tips for you. When you are submerged in this criminal underworld, everyone is your enemy. You help these sorry excuses for masterminds become who they strive to be, but in the meantime, you are helping them gain an upper hand. You are breeding criminals, making them your equals, when really you should be degrading them, tricking them, and making them no more than an ant under your shoe. With your hand feeding these men and women, they will one day come back to bite you. And who is to blame? That's correct. You. With the internet at our fingertips today, it just seems too easy to get what you want. I learned the hard way. It all started with manipulating a few peers as a young lad. They were the puppets on my strings, and it has escalated since then into my now empire of deception. Don't get me wrong, girl. I do appreciate your efforts, but in my world, you are the ant, and I am the shoe. This is no threat, just advice from one mastermind to another who has been playing this game far longer than you've been alive. Best regards, Professor James Moriarty. Sasha Alsberg has signed off. The Blessings of Little Wants by Sarah Ennie. Sigrid Balfour hated having to use magic to balance an enormous pile of paper while unlocking her dorm room door. In her extracurricular studies, she was just getting the hang of bending time. Using powers to prevent a clumsy disaster felt mildly humiliating. Then, adding insult to injury, a voice from within startled her so badly that she shrieked and threw the papers into the air. Sigrid raised her hands, sheets scattering around her like a paper-cut blizzard. A whispered breath, and the source of the voice was flung onto the bed and pinned there. Breathing hard, Sigrid examined her intruder.
"God bleeding damn it, Thomas," she said.
He blinked, and Sigrid realized she was still holding his paralysis. She lowered her hands.
"All I said was hello," Thomas said, stretching his arms and legs to shake off the lingering sting of magical binding. "Bit jumpy?"
Glowering, Sigrid flicked her wrist. Thomas started, clutching at his chest. He gasped an inhale.
"What was that?"
"Made your heart skip a beat," Sigrid said. "Who's jumpy now?"
"No need to get all kinetic on me," Thomas sniffed.
He sat up and ran a hand through his helter-skelter hair, dark brown and tinged with the occasional gray. It never obeyed. Thomas looked flushed and windblown even on the clearest London day. He relaxed against the wall, as comfortable as if it were his own dorm room, which, based on the amount of time he spent here, it might as well have been.
"If you can't stand the wrath, don't set fire to the kitchen," Sigrid said, bending to pick up loose sheets.
She placed a stack on the desk and drew back a curtain to let in the dying sunlight. Had Thomas been sitting here in the dark?
"Did you hear that the proclamation on limiting magic passed?" he asked. "They didn't even amend the language on practical use. Pendle Hill has the right to keep us from using the most basic spells." "Thomas, it's bad enough magic is stretched thin as the Queen's mustache. Now,
Thomas!"
Sigrid raised rigid half-fists, threatening imminent strangulation. Thomas quieted. She pressed her hands together.
"Not today. Please."
She'd listened to some version of this rant for years, that Chancellor Duhamel and his government were conspiring with Pendle Hill leaders to scout and recruit witches born with acute natural abilities, then teach the weaker ones as little as possible to thwart their magical capacity. There was only so much magic in the world, and it ebbed and flowed as witches were born and died, learned and forgot how to be powerful. Duhamel and his cronies aimed to keep as much as possible for themselves. 3 years ago, it sounded like a conspiracy theory, but it wasn't just fringe observers wondering about it anymore. Sigrid and Thomas both curbed their substantial powers to avoid Pendle Hill's merit award system, which involved long visits to the Chancellor's office, from which students returned quieter, more cautious, diminished somehow. Thomas reached down and grabbed one of the loose sheets. He began reading in a fake British accent he knew Sigrid couldn't stand.
"In my time at Pendle Hill, I've learned that cooperation between witches is paramount to solving the problems facing our kind, particularly the crisis of distribution of the world's finite supply of magic."
He paused, pretending to adjust a monocle.
Diminishing magic in the United Kingdom cannot be tolerated, but only through robust negotiation can the International Chamber of Spellcraft hope to balance the needs of the many.
Sigrid groaned. Stop, please. Filling out applications is like meeting the tax accountant you never knew lived inside you. It's horrid.
I don't know why you even bother, Thomas said. Any position available will be beneath your abilities.
He crumpled up the paper and tossed it to her. She caught the wadded-up ball with a sigh.
What choice do we have? Sigrid asked, weary. We can't risk letting anyone know how powerful we are. We have to do the same as everyone else. Get a position, live a normal life.
Thomas shook his head, face full of pity. He chewed the ever-present cud of cot leaf he kept tucked in his cheek.
A cubicle gig doing busy work until you retire or die? I wouldn't call that a life.
The minutiae of a normal existence. Dating, seeing friends, yelling at said friends about what Fontelli, Sigrid said, uncrumpling the application. She had one particular friend in mind, but didn't dare say the name. Annabel Bates. Thomas and Annabel never quite got on, as in, on speaking terms. But if Sigrid had to brave a future filled with as many trifles and as little magic as possible, the thought of meeting Annabel at the pub every night was a silver lining. She tapped the mostly empty pages.
There's something to be said for little wants. I've seen what you can do, Thomas said quietly. What we're both capable of. I don't think we could have little wants if we tried. We need to do something, something big. We need to make a change.
You sound like my father.
Your father was a great man.
Thomas shrugged. Sigrid looked away.
Not to me.
Annabel appeared in the doorway and knocked gently.
Sorry, is this a bad time?
Sigrid sat up straight. Annabelle's lips were pink and puckered as a petal, her hair a shining sheet of golden brown.
It's a fine time, Sigrid said, flashing a bright smile. Have you had a minute to look over my CV?
Sigrid slapped her forehead.
Ugh, I forgot, Belle, I'm sorry.
Annabel glanced at Thomas's satchel by the bed, spilling books onto the floor.
Too busy at the library?
Something like that,
Sigrid said, rolling her eyes at Thomas.
Well, listen, the application for the position at Chancellor Dumel's office is due next Friday. I don't want to be a pain, but it's a position in his office, like his actual office, and...
As Annabel went on about the potential of collating the Chancellor's personal memos, lights began to dance at the corner of Sigrid's vision, amorphous, shining shapes that spun across Annabelle's face. They broke apart into tiny pinpoint stars, rotating in foreign constellations. Thomas's magic worked this way sometimes, when he wanted to show Sigrid something beautiful, or when he couldn't rein it in. The lights formed a halo around Annabelle's face, then broke apart to wring her neck. Altering another witch's sight or mind was reserved for sorcerer-level graduate students, spellcraft neither condoned nor achievable for almost anyone at university level. But Thomas had been showing Sigrid private magic since first year. She'd never told Annabel or anyone else. Both she and Thomas had worked so hard to hide the extent of their powers. At times, Sigrid worried Thomas had hidden it too well. He was nearly invisible to their classmates, and besides her, hadn't made any real friends. She wished it was possible to praise the beauty of his spellcraft and show him off to the world. But ultimately she did as she always had, kept the special parts of Thomas close and secret and safe. The stars dissolved as Thomas rubbed at his eyes, yawning.
Sig? Hello?
Annabel raised an eyebrow. Sigrid blinked, clearing her mind.
Sorry.
Annabel shook her head, smiling.
I think you hung with me there for about 10 seconds. A record.
She nodded to the stacks of papers behind Sigrid.
How are your applications coming?
Oh, you know.
Sigrid held up the partially crumpled sheet.
Swimmingly.
Right, Annabel said dryly. I'll remember this moment when you get every position you apply for, per usual.
She backed away from the door.
Well, let me know when you get to it.
Annabel sauntered down the hall. Sigrid stood in the doorway, watching her.
If you want evidence that magic is shrinking, look no further than Annabel Bates, Thomas said. She couldn't conjure a sense of direction.
Sigrid threw a pen at his head.
Cork it, you elitist hag.
Thomas swatted the pen, sending it flying. It snagged a hanging mobile of tarot cards, sending the hand-painted figures spinning. Empress, Page of Wands, Fool, Death. Sigrid moved to the bed, displacing pillows to sit beside Thomas, forcing their limbs together into a comfortable jumble. Magic had a particular warmth, a kind of glow that lingered after a series of spells had been cast. Thomas seemed to radiate that heat all the time. The cot leaf made him smell ever so slightly of licorice. Together, those elements felt like home. Thomas was the only one who knew, really knew, what Sigrid was. At his side was the only place she could relax.
"The way you look at Annabelle,"
Thomas shook his head.
"She's the one making you think you want a boring, normal life, but you're Sigrid, the Viking Queen."
He put an arm around Sigrid's shoulders and pulled her in.
"You're destined for something more. You could be a legend."
She knew Thomas meant to be reassuring, but Sigrid wasn't sure whether a destiny like that was a blessing or a curse. She watched the tarot mobile slow. The last shaft of sunlight illuminated the tower card, a portent of change, on which two medieval figures plummeted to their deaths. The tea in the Pendle Hill fourth-year clubroom was always weak and a little too cold, its scattered couches so worn they felt like sacks stuffed with hay. But its makeshift library was a sanctuary, with books packed too deep on gently sagging shelves and stacked in leather-bound stalagmites. Thomas had read them all, so Sigrid felt she had, too. He'd begun reorganizing the collection using a mix of the Dewey Decimal System, alphabetical order, and unknowable whimsy. Thomas was stretched over the room's sole table, piles of open books before him. At his elbow was a legal pad jammed with frenetic scribbling. His feet were tucked under the chair, half fallen out of cheap loafers that had begun to fray, clinging desperately to peeling soles. Sigrid wanted badly to reach down and tuck his ankles back in. At the click of her approaching heels, Thomas looked up. He gave her outfit a once-over.
"Looking positively witchy."
Sigrid wore huge sunglasses and a ratty tweed overcoat purchased at the estate sale of a rich, eccentric crone.
"Cadaverous," was how one man on the street described it.
His smile was luminescent.
"Yes, that's it exactly."
Sigrid tripped on one of the books piled at Thomas's feet and stopped in her tracks. Gingerly, as though handling an ancient artifact, she picked up the navy hardcover. She held a gasp in her throat. The book was so familiar to Sigrid, she could have drawn its cover from memory. A gold foil outline of Scotland's northern coast, with a giant X floating in the far northeastern sea, just past the last island.
"Where did you get this?" Sigrid asked.
"Which?"
Thomas looked up.
"Ah, rummage sale. Felt old in all the right ways. Why? What is it?"
"It's Unnatural Troubles," Sigrid said. "A biography of Alice Gray. I had this exact book as a kid. Read it so many times I about had it memorized."
"Alice Gray?"
She raised an eyebrow at Thomas's confused look.
"Of the Heather Blether Expedition?"
He shook his head.
"Seriously?"
Sigrid removed a stack of volumes from the other chair and sat on the edge, clutching the book in her lap.
"Oh, but you'll love this story," she said. "I can't believe you haven't heard of it. That's what you get for being born a Yank."
She cleared her throat, relishing the moment.
"It was about 20 years ago, right after McClatchy introduced his theory of magical scarcity," Sigrid began. "Alice was attending Pendle Hill at the time. She was an incredible witch, top of her class, had a position with the International Chamber lined up, the works. When the McClatchy study proved that magic was a static resource being stretched disproportionately over a bloating population, everything was chaos. It was the end times. Countries were hoarding magic. Charlatans claimed they could create more."
"This part I know," Thomas said.
"Oh, you've decided to start listening in modern magical history," Sigrid said dryly. "Bully for you. Anyway, Alice started researching a legend from Orkney, near the northernmost bit of Scotland,
about an all-knowing and reclusive sorcerer. Supposedly, he lives on a mystical island called Heather Leather, which disappears most of the year. If any witch sets foot on the island, they can claim it, along with all the sorcerer's wisdom. Omnipotence might come with some answers to the magical scarcity problem, or at least that's what Alice thought. And she wasn't alone. She got a group of 8 other witches together, and they formed an expedition to go north in search of Heather Blether and its sorcerer. But something happened. Thomas leaned forward, listening. Sigrid's cheeks flushed with the thrill of telling the story that had entranced her as a child. They ferried to Einhollow, an abandoned island off the Orkney coast. According to legend, if you want to find Heather Blether, you launch from there. That was the last time anyone saw them alive. She paused. Weeks later, investigators found Alice and 2 others among monastic ruins on Einhollow, laid out in an occult formation and covered in black markings. They hadn't been killed. They died of exposure. Thomas's eyes widened. Another 3 were found on the shore. They had internal wounds but no soft tissue damage. It was almost like they'd been taken under the sea, crushed. Sigrid pressed her hands together in the air and washed up on the sand. Thomas's smile was gone, but his eyes glistened. Sigrid had his full attention. As she went on with the story, her vision darkened at the corners. A mist clouded her eyes. Thomas was so focused on her story, he was imagining it in his, and now her, mind. The final 3 weren't found for ages, Sigrid continued. Investigators thought maybe their boat had been taken up by tides, or that they'd gotten lost in the Orkney fog and were dashed on the rocks of another island. Thomas envisioned a steely gray haze over choppy, white-capped waves. Sigrid had read every account of Alice Gray and the Heather Blether expedition in her father's expansive library, and she'd pictured Einhollow's shore much as Thomas did now, dreary with mist, a dark shadow hinting at a rowboat through the menacing fog. She went on. Eventually they found the wreckage, at the bottom of the North Atlantic. Thomas's vision shifted, dreamlike, under the waves, into a murky netherworld. Sigrid's skin bristled with goosebumps as Thomas imagined the brackish dim. His ocean floor held dark dunes of sand, interrupted by crags thrusting upward like carnivore teeth. The boat lay on its side, nestled between 2 bloody-knuckled outcrops. A hole had been drilled into it, Sigrid said, her voice eerily distant. From beneath. Thomas imagined a hole on the boat's damaged bottom, pristine and circular. The final 3 witches were found nearby. They appeared, vivid as Thomas's smile had been to Sigrid just moments ago, skin gray and bloated, wispy hair floating up from lifeless heads. Their feet were buried in the ocean bed's ashy sand, bodies twisting in the current like tangled seaweed. So much worse. Sigrid pushed back against the pull of Thomas's vision. They'd been there for ages. Under her influence, the witch's skin lifted away, peeling off their necks and arms. Their faces came into sharper focus, eyes open to reveal milky white irises. Vaguely, Sigrid registered Thomas grabbing her hand. They'd been branded, too, Sigrid said, pressing into Thomas's perspective and projecting pentagrams of warped scar tissue on the witches' chests. Before they died. Thomas squeezed tighter and tighter, folding the bones of her hand in his fist like a bundle of sticks. Sigrid, he said, voice strained. Just as quickly as it had appeared, the vision was gone, replaced by the dim light of the clubroom. What remained was a splitting headache.
What was that? Thomas said, releasing her hand. You were changing images in my head.
He exhaled like he'd been holding a breath for days.
Have you always been able to do that?
I'm not sure. Sigrid clutched her throbbing head. She thought of all the times Thomas had foisted visions on her in the last 3 years.
Doesn't feel quite right, does it?
Thomas adjusted his shoulders as though shaking something off.
Do you think Alice found him, the sorcerer? Thomas asked.
If she didn't, she said, then what the bloody hell killed her?
Thomas looked away.
So what happened to the next team? What? The ones who tried it next? What came of them?
Thomas, everyone in the Heather Blether expedition died. Horribly. People weren't exactly lining up to repeat their mistake.
Mistake?
Thomas said, stunned.
They knew exactly what they were doing, trying to save magic. Being brave is a risk, not a mistake. They wanted to be extraordinary, to embrace all that they were capable of, to be legend.
Descriptions of Alice Gray's body filled Sigrid's mind. Her skin sucked tight around her bones, scarred with symbols no expert had been able to interpret.
Why be extraordinary if that's the cost?
Thomas grabbed her wrist.
Because of the cost of doing nothing.
He met her gaze with a challenge.
People die either way. If you act, at least their blood isn't on your hands.
Sigrid shook off his grip and stood.
Alice might have owed the world some magic. I don't think she owed us her life.
Sigrid! Annabelle swept into the room. Time to get your head out of those books, Sig, old girl.
You've no idea.
Sigrid agreed. She grabbed her bag and turned her back on Thomas.
I need a break from him.
Who?
Annabelle threw an arm around Sigrid and steered her toward the billiards table in the other corner. A group of scraggly boys were getting ready to start a game. They twisted chalk on their cues and watched the girls approach.
Here's what we're going to do, Annabelle said. We're going to watch these wankers play pool, bet on the one with the cutest ass, and by the end of the night we won't care about who's won, or applications, or London, or any damn thing.
Sigrid looked back and saw Thomas stuffing his satchel with books. She could see the disappointment in his eyes. Sigrid was easily seduced into Annabelle's world of casual fun. When Annabelle was around, it seemed so simple to knock off and enjoy things, to ignore the part of her brain that buzzed with anxious thoughts, focusing instead on a drink, a flirt, the possibility of comfort and peace. In time, she could learn to mimic the easy cadence of Annabelle's crowd, Sigrid told herself. She could be happy. The billiards table was crowded with Pendle Hill's finest. They stood close, jostling and throwing insults, alive with laughter. Sigrid wondered when, exactly, they'd all grown so comfortable with one another. Annabelle leaned against the wall, talking to a student whose name Sigrid couldn't recall. Blake, maybe, or Blair, or Blaine. They were talking about positions, of course.
I'm after one with Manchester United,
Blake Blair Blaine said.
Wow, Annabelle said. That's on.
Wait, what?
Sigrid said, sharp.
You're a witch. You know that, right?
Right,
he said.
What of it?
You can do magic, and you want to work for a football club.
Not just any club, is it?
Sigrid shook her head, incredulous.
Who cares? You'd never be able to use your abilities. You'd be forever hiding what you are.
Blake Blair Blaine shrugged.
It's not like I'm saving the world, levitating small objects, or hexing stains out of my loafers. Parlor tricks.
Exactly, Annabelle laughed.
She tossed her gleaming hair. She was flirting, Sigrid realized, and with that unevolved cretin. Sigrid longed to retaliate somehow, to decelerate the billiard balls until they retraced their trajectories, maybe send the whole room back to a few minutes before the game had even started, show Annabelle and all the rest a fraction of the power they so casually dismissed. But she'd been so careful to keep the extent of her powers under wraps. Just because she wanted to prove a point didn't mean she suddenly trusted her classmates. In that moment, Sigrid understood that being extraordinary wasn't something she could curb forever. There was no opting out.
Parlor tricks.
Right.
Sigrid turned to Annabelle.
Want to get out of here?
Annabelle hesitated. Sigrid's stomach dropped. Her face flared red at the sight of Annabelle's pitying expression.
Well, Sigrid said, it's been a gas.
Annabelle twisted her mouth up.
Oh, come on, Sig. Don't go.
Her fingers grazed Sigrid's lightly. Sigrid drew her arm back.
Don't go is not the same as stay.
She pulled the satchel strap over her shoulder.
Have a good life, Sigrid said, stepping away. You deserve it.
That Sunday morning, like every other, Sigrid waited for Thomas at the kebab stand by the river across the Thames from Parliament. Thomas's approaching form was unmistakable, shoulders curled under a wool camel coat and a short-legged gait slightly off for his limber frame.
Kebab?
His eyes brightened at the food cart's rotating slab of lamb. Thomas always offered, and Sigrid always refused. They fell into an easy stride, pacing side by side. They'd been taking these walks since the first term. It was here that Thomas had admitted no one in the States knew he was a witch. He hadn't been back to visit in 3 years, so far as Sigrid could recall, and it was where she first admitted out loud that she'd been holding back in lessons, afraid to show anyone all that she was capable of. It felt like whispering secrets into a forgetful wind. They sat on a bench just off the walkway, under a dogwood tree. The sun peered from behind clouds, falling on the river's choppy surface like flashing diamonds.
"So, Alice Gray," Thomas said. "I've been researching her and Heather Blether. Her diary was in the school library, hadn't been checked out in a dozen years. She was top of her class, brains beyond reason, awash in banality, striving to be great."
"I know." Sigrid knew the diary. She knew all the books Thomas must have devoured in the last few days. The story of Heather Blether had consumed her for years. Now it was all coming back again. Thomas ran a hand through his hair, leaving spikes in its wake.
"She's you," he said.
"What are you on about?"
"She's you, Sig, I swear it. She was extraordinary and looking for a mission worthy of her talents. Saving magic."
"Fat lot of good it did her. Or any of her friends."
Thomas shook his head.
"That isn't the point. They were willing to try."
He paused.
"And anyway, there are theories."
Sigrid squinted at him. Thomas continued.
"Things they could have done differently. There are legends from Iceland and Norway about what travelers can do to ward off the sorcerer's influence, or to stay mentally agile in his presence. He poses riddles, apparently, some kind of clever ultimatum, and those who answer are magically bound by the outcome."
He nudged her gently with his elbow.
"There's also the fact that we're far more powerful than Alice was."
"We can't know that."
"If Alice or any of the witches in the expedition were as powerful as we are, she would have noted it."
"What are you saying?"
"We could do it, Sig. You and me. By claiming the island and gaining all the sorcerer's knowledge, we could save magic."
Thomas turned to her, his face cast in mottled shadow under the flowering tree. Thomas leaned back against the bench, eyes shut.
"The day I learned that the word for what I am was magic, that was the best day of my life."
As he spoke, the velvety white petals of the dogwood tree's flowers began to unfurl.
"You can't tell me this is all life is. Just another way to wear a suit and work till we expire."
The petals began to shimmer, filling with blues and reds and purples.
"Alice wanted the world to open for her, to show her something incredible and new. She saw the chance to be a legend, and she took it."
Sigrid felt a shiver as the idea bloomed in her mind, wild and absurd and, somehow, inevitable. Sigrid's heart kicked into overdrive. For the first time, she let herself envision the future that would unfurl from going north to face a great unknown. Gently, she placed a hand on Thomas's shoulder. He opened his eyes. Sigrid nodded up at the tree. The dogwood's flowers had blossomed in fluorescent hues, gleaming like gently folded rainbows. Thomas blinked, and every petal released, fluttering down around them like natural confetti. Flecks of lavender and fuchsia and goldenrod settled in his hair and on his shoulders, brushing his lapel like a telltale kiss.
"Alice Gray never found that new, incredible thing," Sigrid said.
"She died trying," Thomas said. "That's more than most of us will die doing."
He searched her face.
"You're more than Alice Gray could have ever hoped to be."
Sigrid thought of Annabelle's wide eyes and easy smile. She imagined leaving a mind-numbing potion in the city to catch drinks with Annabelle at a pub, hoping half-witted hooligans would pay their tab, waking up with fuzzy heads the next morning, the greatest hope being a repeat of the previous day. The thought that she could learn that rhythm,
was a lie she could no longer stomach. For all the witches hiding their power. For magic.
Thomas's hand grazed her cheek, thumb wiping away the single tear that fell there.
For Alice.
Sigrid rested her hand on his arm. He gave a surprised shout as she pinched him, hard.
For ourselves.
They wasted little time. Monday morning, they were at the train station. Thomas was a wreck. He couldn't figure out the ticket machine or navigate the station. He became so overwhelmed that Sigrid eventually told him to shut up and follow her lead. The moment she deposited him in the train cabin, he folded a new leaf of cot in his mouth, sank low with his head against the window pane, and began to snore. Sigrid sat on the bench across from him and bit her nails, watching London recede in their wake. Her pack sagged at her feet, stuffed with survival equipment and magical tools. She'd brought an iron stake, according to legend, a must for any traveler hoping to come upon the hidden island, and a carnelian stone to help point the way. Several small cloth bags were filled with various gemstones and crystals, healing and amplifying, heart opening and evil warding. These items and matches and their wits. Hours later, Thomas woke.
Hello, he said, groggily righting himself.
Sigrid stared at him.
What are we doing? She asked. Alice and the others were prepared. They planned extensively. They'd been circling together for weeks before they left. Knew each other's magic inside and out. You know my magic, Thomas said. You know everything.
He reached for Sigrid's feet, propped on the bench beside him. Sigrid drew them back. He sighed.
You've been preparing for this your whole life.
As they chugged farther into the highlands, the world became oversaturated in the eerie blue-green of a dense forest, or of leagues under the sea. A curve in the tracks revealed a wide, churning river outside the window. The train soared over it on a bridge so thin Sigrid felt like they were flying. He was right, of course. Every kilometer they traveled felt like it was bringing Sigrid closer to where she was meant to be, or perhaps where she could not have avoided ending up. Ferrying a boat to Einhollow was difficult. It was the off-season, and local fishermen were superstitious about the tides. Finally, they found an ancient mariner swathed in a cloak, eating canned fish beside a rusted trawler. They had to repeat their request 3 times while the man gummed sardines with golden teeth, but eventually he'd nodded. Neither Thomas nor Sigrid dared ask any questions when he immediately ushered them onto his boat and untied it from the dock, its sputtering engine jettisoning them away from shore. The wind was icy and merciless. Sigrid inched nearer to Thomas, aglow as ever with warmth. His eyes, clear and sharp as glass, darted across the water as the boat sliced through the sound. The fisherman killed the engine, and the trawler glided toward a dilapidated dock. Sigrid leaped from the boat's deck to the dock, grasping Thomas's hand in terror. Luckily, the dock held, though its wooden slats were softer under her tread.
"Best be careful, miss. Fog's rolling in,"
the mariner said, his Orkney accent nearly unintelligible.
"Don't seem right. A young woman traveling the islands alone."
Sigrid narrowed her eyes in confusion. Within moments, the trawler receded into the mist.
"Crazy old dodger," Thomas muttered, shouldering his pack.
Einhollow was tiny and flat, tipped like a dish in a sink. The tall end, buttressed by craggy cliffs, rolled down to a shallow shoreline on the other side. The edges of the island were hidden by a creeping mist. Like many places empty of people, Einhollow brimmed with all manner of the inhuman. Sigrid felt a lingering dread and the buzz of unfamiliar magic just under the skin. The island's undulating green was littered with moss-covered boulders and anonymous cairns. The whipping wind sent a chill right to the bone. It was not hard to believe, navigating the pockmarked landscape, that this was about as close as one could get to the edge of the world. Thomas set off north and slightly west, across the heart of the island, directly through the monastery remains where Alice Gray and her 2 fellows had been found. He moved among the ruins with an odd ease, as though returning to a place he once knew.
The rubble was crawling with latent hexes. The wind seemed to whistle around the crumbling ruins. Or was it a whisper? Sigrid crouched in the grass near Alice's final resting place. What force could possibly have made someone so smart and accomplished willingly lie down to die? Sigrid shut her eyes and tried to call forth any residual magic, anything Alice might have left behind. There was something, a wisp of a feeling. Sigrid opened herself to it, allowing her heart to be touched by what remained of Alice's soul. Fear. Fathomless, unhinged fear. Entangled in the dread and anger, a warning. Don't trust the choice. Sigrid recoiled, pulling her wool coat tight around herself. Thomas led them to the shore. Their footsteps in the short, wiry grass made no sound and left no mark. The fog bank had farther advanced, and there was nothing now to differentiate the steel-gray ocean from its rough of murk. They stood at the water's edge, squinting. Sigrid tried not to think of the other explorers found on the sand, grasping. The image of their half-rotted bodies crept over her sight in that now familiar way. In the cold, surrounded by such powerful and foreign energy, she lacked the will to fight off Thomas's visions. Sigrid saw what he saw, the gruesome spectacle of death. Just beyond the bodies, one of the rowboats was beached, nodding in the lapping waves. "Thomas," Sigrid warned. As quickly as the vision crept in, it washed away. But Sigrid blinked, once, twice, and still the boat remained. Thomas grasped it by the bow. He'd conjured the boat whole cloth from his own mind.
"Are you ready?"
he asked, planting one foot inside the vessel. He reached a hand out to her. Alice's warning echoed in Sigrid's mind, but she and Thomas had come this far. There was no turning back. Sigrid took Thomas's hand and crawled into the boat, gasping as it teetered in the shallows. They shoved off from shore, and within minutes, Ine Hollow disappeared. Sigrid held fast to the iron stake. With her other hand, she worried the carnelian stone hanging around her neck, which seemed to pulse and warm as Thomas rowed.
"What's it saying?"
Thomas asked.
"Are we on the right track?"
Sigrid shut her eyes and held the stone tight in her palm. She called forth the memory of Alice's ghost and its desperate cry. As the stone throbbed, Alice's warning grew louder, stronger, and more urgent.
"We're getting closer," Sigrid said. "Keep rowing."
The mist around them, dark as pitch when they left the shore, began to warm and brighten. It was a contrast to the growing burden of Alice's screams pressing in on Sigrid's mind.
"Closer," she said, breathing shallow. "Very close."
Not a minute later, the boat scraped rocky land. Thomas leaped over the bow and dragged it farther ashore. Steep cliffs loomed over the shore. They walked cautiously, looking for any path, any sign of life.
"Don't lose grip of the stake,"
Thomas called over her shoulder. Sigrid held it to her chest with a white-knuckle grip. If she let go, Heather Blether could disappear entirely. The stone in Sigrid's hand began to throb with heat.
"The sorcerer. He's near," she whispered.
A sharp crackling was the only warning before rocks rained down on them. Thomas grabbed Sigrid and shoved her against the cliff, flattening them both. When the storm of debris slowed, they saw a shape atop the crag, a darker shadow in dark fog. Sigrid examined the cliffside. She tucked the iron stake into her bra. Its rough edges cut the gentle skin of her chest. Using slim footholds and crevasses in the cliff's sheer sides, she climbed closer to the top, until finally her aching fingers grasped a flat edge with grass and stubborn-rooted plants. Sigrid looked up and saw Thomas peering over the side.
"How did you..."
Before Sigrid could finish her question, she felt her toes slipping.
"Help!"
she gasped. Thomas just stared. Sigrid's grip on the shrubs and barbed plants started to give way, shallow roots peeling back from the crag. With a final, desperate heave, Sigrid dragged her elbows over the top. Using the last of her strength, she hauled one leg, then another, over the edge. On her knees, she took gasping breaths. From the corner of her eye, she saw the filthy toes of Thomas's trainers.
"You rotting bastard!" she rasped, lifting her head.
But past Thomas, through the dawn-like glow of mist pressing in on them, a dusky shape moved. Walking. Toward them. Thomas turned. Sigrid stood. The figure moved through a halo of golden light. It took the shape of a broad-chested man wearing an elegantly draped tunic with a wide braided belt and a heavy cloak lined with fur.
"It's you," Sigrid breathed.
He had olive skin and a mass of dark curls. His trimmed beard held two prongs of gray. He seemed to hold light, to exude an aura of calm.
"I don't know your name," she said.
The man shook his head.
"You've brought much with you."
He waved a hand, and the earth beside him cratered, forming a pit of loamy dirt. With a snap of his fingers, a fire appeared there, absent kindling to stoke the flame. It burned green and sulphurous.
"It must all be sacrificed to get what you seek."
Sigrid shook her head.
"How do you know what I'm after?" she asked.
The man held his arms wide.
"You seek everything," he said simply.
"Like all the rest. But first, you must choose."
"Choose?"
The man shifted his dark eyes to Thomas.
"The others, or yourself?"
Sigrid shook her head.
"I don't understand."
"Only one of you can continue. If you seek to know all, to apprentice the heavens, to shape the universe, you must make a decision."
Sigrid looked down and gasped. The iron stake was in her hand, biting the thin skin of her fingers. Thomas stepped back. He stared at her with an eerie calm, the look that had returned fire for so many all-night arguments. The same expression that had gawked, unfeeling at her as she teetered on the edge of the cliff.
"This was the choice you gave Alice Gray," Sigrid said, meeting the sorcerer's black eyes.
He raised an eyebrow.
"After a fashion?"
In the end, the expedition had been asked to sacrifice one another so one among them could gain everything, and they'd all said no. Alice had said no. Extraordinary, Thomas had called them. Brilliant. Selfless. Stupid. Brave. Thomas had no weapons, but his hands twitched at his sides, itching to gesture magic into being. Sigrid's vision began to darken. He was calling magic to him and pulling her into his sight. He never did learn to control it.
"What happened to saving the world?"
Sigrid whispered.
"One of us would," Thomas said, shaking his head. "And one of us can die trying. A legend, just like Alice."
The blackness overwhelmed her vision. Then Sigrid saw herself through Thomas's eyes, staring back with a look that could cut diamond. Her white blonde hair, loose from its braid, whipped around her head in the chaotic ocean wind. She stood just a few yards from the cliff's edge, legs spread wide, arms tight at her sides, a warrior's stance. Her grip on the stake was so tight, blood seeped between her fingers. Thomas was waiting for Sigrid to follow in Alice Gray's footsteps, to take the selfless path, to be brave. When Thomas said Sigrid could have it all, he meant until it cost him something. He wanted her to sacrifice herself, leaving Thomas to save magic and take all the glory. But Thomas had said it himself. If Alice had been half as powerful as they were, things would have been different. Don't trust the choice. In her final moments, Alice had been filled with terror and regret for her sacrifice. All Sigrid felt was calm. Sigrid watched herself advance on Thomas, arm raised. She witnessed the cold glaze in her own eyes as her hand arced down, burying the iron stake in his stomach. Sigrid grabbed Thomas and shoved him back, pushing the stake farther into his soft belly, dragging him to the cliff's edge. Her hand was warm with his gushing blood. His body twitched, fighting the lightning-fast march to death.
"I didn't come here to save magic," she said,
her ice-blue eyes calm and clear. I came here to prove that I could. And when she blinked, release. Thomas's head rolled up to the honeyed sky as his body fell backward to the shore. In the next blink, Sigrid returned.